for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Pakistani soldiers were the apparent target of two suicide bombings today in Lahore that killed dozens. An upsurge in violence this week follows a recent crackdown on Taliban militants. In Iraq, allegations of vote tampering could complicate determining the outcome of national elections. And Israel has sealed off the West Bank for 48 hours, fearing unrest over deadlocked peace talks and plans for a new settlement in East Jerusalem. Joining me in the studio to talk about the top international stories on today's Friday News Roundup, Warren Strobel of McClatchy's News Bureau, Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center TV, and Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine. Do join us. You are always a part of the program. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Michael Hirsch, what are the early results of the election in Iraq?
Well, they're just trickling in, and it was going to take days and possibly weeks before we know the final results of the vote, much less what the final shape of the government is going to look like. But in the early returns, it does seem as if Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's State of Law Party, a mainly Shiite but not only Shiite party, is dominating the returns, particularly in some of the southern provinces where the votes have come in. And Ayad Alawi's largely secular but still Sunni-dominated party is lagging behind. And the big question hanging over this is how long is it going to take to piece something together, and will it last? And, of course, I think the nightmare that both the Americans there and the Iraqis themselves remember all too well is what happened in December 2005, when it took more than 150 days to piece together a government. And during that time, a sectarian war broke out.
Nadia.
I think, Diane, I spoke to somebody who works for the UN there, and he was telling me he was struck by how normal was the process. You have to accredit the Iraqis. They take into this election as if they've been doing it for 100 years. And it's very interesting. Although they distrust all politicians, but they showed up in number. About 62% of Iraqis voted in this election. And, of course, the government's going to take a long time to form, and that's understandable. But if you look at the example, Iraq is not a democracy, but the process of the election is a democracy. One and parallel in the Arab world. If you look at how this government is going to emerge, or the coalition party is going to emerge to form a government, you know, the jockeying for power, including this party or that party, who's going to be the kingmakers? Will it be the Kurds? Will it be the Sadrists? Who's going to be represented? I think it's fascinating to watch. And the rest of the Arab world, the Arab world will be watching. But I think ultimately the one who was out of the pictures were the Americans.
What
the Iraqis were in charge in the security as well.
What about allegations of fraud, Warren?
I think the UN spokesman there in Iraq today said that these allegations of fraud are overwrought or exaggerated, and he sees no widespread fraud as the type we saw in the Afghan election. I agree with Michael that the government formation is one of the key questions. I think the overarching question, though, is can Iraq find a way to incorporate the Sunnis into political life? The Sunnis are 21% roughly of the country. They ran it during Saddam's years. They have seen their role marginalized. And if there's not some way to bring them back into politics, they're going to return to violence. And, you know, American officials talk like this is the red zone. We're at the end of the day here. I talked a couple of weeks ago to Ryan Crocker, the former ambassador to Iraq, and he said this can go either way, and it can go either way for a long time. So it's very much on the bubble.
So what's the effect on U.S. troops of the election, Nadia?
I think they will withdraw on time, and I think this is the success of President Obama. He will keep one of his promises during the campaign. And I think, as I said, it was amazing to see how the Iraqi security services were in charge of the whole process from beginning to end, including the U.N. security for the staff to go to polling stations all over Iraq, not just in Baghdad. dead. So I think that there is agreement among all the politicians in Iraq that they wanted the American troops out. They see it, they see them as an occupation forces. I think the sooner the better. And I think it will help the process to heal, as opposed to some people who predicted if the American troops leave, it's going to be a civil war. Yeah. I don't think that scenario is going
to
happen.
Yeah, it's important to distinguish between now and the December 2005 vote. There are similarities, but there are very important differences. I mean, one, the Sunnis at that time basically boycotted the vote. Now they're complaining about being disqualified because of Ba'athist links, and they're complaining about fraud. But they took part, and despite, I'm sure they'll be complaining right up into the 11th hour until they do form a government, they are part of the process. And you do have something that's very different from a country that was on the precipice of civil war during that last vote. The civil war has kind of occurred. A lot of the sectarian bloodshed has kind of, gone its path, and so you have a much more integrated and stable country than you had back then. Nonetheless, I do think that in some respects, the big question going forward is not so much this election, but what's the next election going to look like after the Americans have already departed?
Well, first, let's hear what General Odierno had to say. He said, this looks very, very good.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, I agree totally with Nadia. I mean, the way the election was conducted, and I was in Iraq all of November, half of December of last year when they were debating the election law, and the sense that you got is exactly what Michael said, which is they want to do everything to avoid going back to 2005, 2007. And before we move on, there's one other little piece of good news, I think, here from the American perspective at least, which is that the Shiite parties who are most closely seen as being tied to Iran, I'm not saying they're Iranian puppets, but the Iraqi National Alliance, this is a coalition that Maliki left, they so far have not, they're doing okay, but they're not doing that well.
Warren Stropel of McClatchy, Washington Bureau, do join us, 800-433-8850. Let's talk about an issue that did not go very well this week when Vice President Biden went to Israel. He went there, Nadia, to assure Israelis of Washington's commitment to its security and to restart peace talks. What happened?
Diane, you have to admire the Israelis. They apologize for the timing, as if they can announce this 1,600 new housing unit will make a huge difference if they did it while he was there or if he was after he leaves. I mean, the settlement issues is the most fundamental issue to undermine the viability of a Palestinian state. And here you are, the most supporter of Israel. Vice President Joe Biden goes there. He talks to Netanyahu and he says, you are my friend. We have unshakable bond. And all of a sudden, the Israelis give him a slap in the face and said, we're going ahead with this. Of course, Netanyahu said, I don't know. It was Elia Shai, who is the interior minister. And if you think Netanyahu is a right-winger, look at his coalition. I mean, there are some people who advocate transfer of Palestinians. But the problem here is undermining the credibility of the Americans in the region. It's weakened President Abbas beyond anybody can imagine. It's another nail in his coffin. He went to Cairo. He talked to the Arab leaders there, and they gave him a green light to talk with the Israelis on this proximity talks. And now the Israelis said, well, I'm sorry, we're going to carry on with the settlements activities. So they put him in a position to withdraw his offer. So the American proposal is dead.
Diane, I mean, this was such a black eye for Netanyahu. It's hard for me to believe that he really wanted to orchestrate this. He does have a very difficult situation keeping this hard right coalition together. He's got a lot of people, including bureaucrats in the Interior Ministry and his own party, you know, who would like nothing better than to undermine the peace talks that he, you know, is now sponsoring. And so it may well have been something that hit him from left field, Netanyahu, that is. It certainly was the intention of some in the Israeli government to embarrass him, and that they did. Remember, any Israeli prime minister who is sort of playing with the Americans and the American alliance in the way that Netanyahu has for the last year since Obama came in is really playing with fire. Netanyahu has done it successfully so far. He's actually become popular by sort of defying Obama. But you can go too far. That's what happened to Netanyahu last time he was prime minister in 1999. He was seen as defying Washington too much, and he was out of office before he knew it. So I think he's aware of that. I'm not so sure that this is what he wanted.
I think the underlying factor here, Diane, is the power of the settler movement in Israel, which used to be sort of a fringe movement or a small movement. These are people who believe that, you know, Israel should be occupying and building on the disputed land. And you now have a situation in Israel. They have tremendous political power. Netanyahu or any other prime minister doesn't want to go against them. And you have a foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who lives in a settlement. And it's an incredibly right-wing coalition that makes peace talks very, very difficult.
Is it truly believable that Netanyahu had no idea that this announcement was going to be made?
I think it could be, actually. And it shows that he has no control over his coalition. As we said, the Shas party where the interior minister come from, he wanted to embarrass him or he wanted to sabotage the peace process because ultimately they're not interested in it. And also another point here is these settlements are in East Jerusalem. And the Israelis always said with Netanyahu others that this is not part of the deal. If we're talking about settlements in the West Bank, they said maybe we can talk about a freeze, but that not includes Jerusalem. So for them, it was natural to go ahead with it. And the timing might be wrong or not wrong, but I think there is a chance that he might not know about it.
And Biden's response, Michael?
Well, Biden's response was to be aghast that, you know, they would take him, you know, the guy basically number two to the president of the United States and embarrass him in this way, take a guy who was more or less on their side and make him an anti-Netanyahu guy. And he, you know, he got his licks back. He kept Netanyahu waiting for 90 minutes before their meeting as an expression of displeasure and came down with some harsh rhetoric. But you know, all in all, he didn't have much else to say.
So at midnight, Israel announces its sealing off the West Bank for 48 hours. What's going on?
Well, for security reasons, they always do that. It's not the first time. Whenever they have a national holiday, whenever anticipated trouble, whenever there is some Palestinian anniversary, they always seal the West Bank. I mean, it's not just near any sealing because they have thousands of checkpoints in the West Bank that separates it from the rest of East Jerusalem and Gaza.
Nadia Bilbasi, she's senior U.S. correspondent for Middle East Broadcast Center TV. Short break. We'll be right back. And we're back with the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine, Nadia Bilbasi of MCB TV, Warren Strobel of McClatchy News. We're going to open the phone shortly. First, though, let's talk about the troop drawdown in Iraq. How might that affect U.S. strategy in Afghanistan? Nadia.
I mean, we talked about increasing number of the U.S. troops in Afghanistan, but where this number is going to come from. So obviously they have to take it from somewhere. The fact that this election might be good news for the Americans, that they will stick to the time, as the president said, end of August, they might withdraw a large number from there and probably take them to Afghanistan. Now, taking them to Afghanistan, whether they're going to make a huge difference or not, that's something debatable. But the success of the American operation in Mirja has given some little bit of positive indication that maybe the situation in Afghanistan is improving, but the battle with the Taliban is a continuous one.
Here's an email. It says, please comment on the fact that the Mirja offensive in Afghanistan was spun as being in a city of 80,000. There is no city of Marja. It's a sprawling agricultural reason. Go to Google Earth, you'll find no city of Marja. McChrystal's War of Perceptions comment is telling, especially in light of the perceptions he helped create regarding Pat Tillman. And we all remember Pat Tillman, who was killed in friendly fire, and the military initially claimed it was the enemy. Warren.
You know, we're going to cross a point here sometime this spring where for the first time since, I think, 2001, we're going to have more troops in Afghanistan than Iraq, as Iraq draws down and Afghanistan goes up. I agree completely with what Nadia said. If you take the temperature at the White House, Obama has every indication of getting those troops down to 50,000, and I think it would take just a catastrophic change in the situation
to reverse that,
and I really seriously doubt that that's going to happen. As far as Marja, I actually did not know that. That's interesting. Warfare is partly perception, and I think you can argue the Marja operation, at least it's initially, has gone pretty well, but the entire battle is whether you can not clear it, but whether you can hold and build there.
It's interesting, isn't it, that Afghan President Karzai hosted the Iranian President Ahmadinejad in Kabul this week. What's the significance of that, Michael?
Well, Karzai is hard at work restoring his reputation both within Afghanistan and the region and in the eyes, you know, of Washington. Now, obviously, seeing and embracing Ahmadinejad doesn't help much with Washington, but he's been working hard at establishing regional diplomacy that's going to keep bordering countries like Iran and Pakistan, out of his situation as we head toward what inevitably are going to be peace talks, probably with the Taliban, and some kind of a settlement. And it's important to remember that for all of the troubles that Ahmadinejad has caused for the rest of the world, in the very early days of the formation of the Afghan government after the fall of the Taliban in 2002, Iran was actually quite helpful in terms of dealing with the western part of the country, and I think that Karzai is at work on that.
And what's the significance of Pakistan's intelligence chief being given another year on the job?
Well, from what I'm told, that is largely about a good working relationship that's developed between him, General Pasha, and General Kiani, the Army Chief of Staff. A lot of positive things have been happening in the last year in terms of cooperation between these two guys, between them and the civilian government led by President Zardari, with the Americans. It actually was explained to me by a Pakistani official as being a largely technical matter of extending General Pasha's retirement age as opposed to the ISI chief, because there were some questions raised, well, is Kayani then going to attempt to do the same thing and extend his tenure as Army Chief of Staff? Which all indications are he really does not want to do that. Remember, Kayani came into this job saying, I don't want to be Pervez Musharraf. I don't want to be seen as the guy who preceded me, who took over the country and, you know, launched a coup. And all indications are that Kayani may actually retire as he's scheduled to do in November.
The Pakistanis have actually been doing an awful lot lately in the recent months in terms of first offensive is in South Waziristan and especially in arresting Taliban and Al-Qaeda figures. But we have to remember, Diane, that they're doing it not because we want them to, but they're doing it for their own reasons. Reason number one is that I think they finally realize they have a serious internal threat, that this is not about Afghanistan, it's about Pakistan. Secondly, they want a seat at the table. They see that there's going to be some talks, and they want to get some street cred by doing this. And secondly, they want to take some players maybe off the table and off the field who don't agree with what they want to do.
And, of course, you had more bombings in Pakistan today.
Of course, because every time the government's taken on the Pakistani Taliban, they wanted to show that they're still there and they're able to hit whenever they want, whether it's a suicide bombing in the major cities or on the border area. But one more thing I wanted to talk back about Ahmadinejad's visit to Kabul as well. It was really interesting, Diane, what he said about Gates, who supposed both of them were supposed to go inside side in the visit, and he was criticizing Secretary Gates, saying, why are you coming 12,000 kilometers away to this neighborhood? And this is like my backyard, basically, which is really interesting. But I think the most interesting part was how he praised for the first time the Afghani security forces and intelligence and the Pakistani one for the arrest of Abdul Malik Reji, who was wanted by the Iranians, who is the head of a guerrilla group called Jundullah, and they've been carrying this grotesque beheading attacks against Iranian security forces. So he wanted to show all of a sudden we are one. Even Karzai said about the Pakistanis, we are twins, and you know, we are together, we are conjoined twins.
The Iranian story, while colorful, is actually a minor element in a more important story, which is the relaxation of tensions between the major players there, Pakistan, India, and obviously Afghanistan. Pakistan and India playing a role in Afghanistan. And it's really quite extraordinary. One can't say that it's going to last, but it really is something. You've seen the Indians announce they're going to, you know, be drawing down their forces. Remember, Afghanistan has always been seen as a place to do proxy war between Pakistan and India. Yeah, I mean, Pakistan helped to set up the Taliban for precisely that reason, as a strategic asset against India. So as a result of a lot of intensive diplomacy by the Americans and others, what you've seen is a kind of a stand down in Afghanistan that may, and I say may, if things go well, allow that country to actually stabilize in the aftermath of the offensive.
All right. I want to take you to another part of the world, and that is to Nigeria, where there have been arrests following the massacre of hundreds of people in three Nigerian villages on Sunday. There were women, there were children. Why were they killed, Warren?
You know, this is a really horrific situation that I think probably doesn't get enough attention in the world media, or certainly in the Western media. I mean, you have hundreds of people killed, and several years ago, I think it was in the thousands. This appears to be a case where Muslims in Nigeria came and attacked Christians in retaliation for a previous attack. And it's happening right in the sort of the fault line between the, I hope I got this right, the Muslim North and the Christian South. Mm-hmm. And there's every prospect that this is going to continue.
But also it happened in Jos province, and there's always been this tension between different ethnic groups. And in this in particular incident, it's like 500 people were massacred, as you said, and it was the Fulani and the Hausa tribes who committed that as a result of what happened in January, which is also Muslim villages were razed to the ground. But sometimes, Diane, it's not just a tension over ethnic or religious, but also sometimes a simple thing as grazing land, cattle, you know, green pasture, etc., because these are tribal areas. And it's very, and even in this attack where the 500 people were killed, there was talk about cattle being seized, even from same Christian groups. So sometimes it's really fight over resources more than just an ethnic.
But it sounds in this case as though Muslims were going after Christians.
Yeah, I mean, this country, you know, has just gotten increasingly out of control, the lack of central authority. And you know, again, as Nadia was just saying, a lot of it is just an intense resource fight over oil wealth, and you know, you've had this going on for decades.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right,
especially
we'll open the phones 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Zach, who's in Fairfax, Virginia. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. A couple of things, actually. Number one, as far as the Nigeria situation, it's a big concern of mine that this is going to be painted as purely a religious conflict when, as one of your guests just mentioned, like really any conflict, it's going to be a conflict over resources primarily, and various justifications or what have you to actually initiate the conflict will be needed, like religious differences or things like that. But fundamentally, it doesn't surprise me at all that this is a conflict over energy or over food or over land. Secondly, regarding the Iraqi elections, I suppose arguably some elections are better than no elections at all. But I'd be interested in the guest's thoughts regarding the allegations that hundreds of potential candidates in Iraq's recent election were barred from running, including a delegate from the second largest Sunni coalition in the Iraqi legislature.
So. Nadia.
I think the one he's referring to is Saleh al-Mutlaq, who is a very well-known, prominent Sunni politician. And I agree, if you look at the de-Ba'athification law that was passed in February 2008 with the pressure of the Americans, that really the primarily the one who wrote it were the Sadris. So there is that definitely that interest of trying to exclude the Sunni minority because they ruled the country and, you know, they were part of the Saddam Hussein government at the time. But the problem now is how to include them. It's good to see in this election that the Sunnis, as Michael said, have not boycotted the election. They learned from the lesson of 2005. Actually, they show a huge number because they realize they're better off inside than being outside. But ultimately, if you look at this new commission headed by Ahmad Chalabi, they were trying to disqualify almost 500 candidates to from any people who had any link with the Baathist
Party. That's certainly a name we know, isn't it, Warren?
He sat in the gallery at the State of the Union address in 2004, right behind Laura Bush.
And very proudly.
Very proudly. And, of course, was one of the guys, not one of the, was one of the main people who offered up bogus intelligence that about Saddam's ties to WMD. One other quick point here, though. The problem with the process in Iraq is that it's been politicized. We've had other cases throughout history after the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, South Africa. We've had Truth and Reconciliation commissions, where there's a very fair and honest process about who is guilty of war crimes, who may be excluded from the political process. But in Iraq, and I think to many Iraqis, especially Sunnis, this was seen as a politicized process.
Yeah, the U.S. orchestrated the arrival of Chalabi and his group actually even before the first U.S. Commissioner there to run civilian Iraq, and we've regretted it ever since. He hasn't stopped making mischief. Again, it's a little time bomb that was planted back in 2003, and it hasn't stopped ticking.
Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about the protests in Greece, which yesterday really turned violent. The police were using tear gas. It was pretty bad, Warren.
It was pretty bad, and I think there's every indication that it's going to continue to be bad because, as we've seen in many cases around the world over the past decades, Argentina, where governments have to impose draconian emergency spending measures, cuts in public services, cuts in government salaries, etc., the populace reacts in this way, and I think it's going to be a tough road ahead.
But you know, it's interesting. Are the Greek people themselves taking on the responsibility for all of the underhanded stuff that's gone on?
Absolutely. And this is, if you look at the protests in the streets, it was organized by the unionists. And they're very powerful in Greece. There's 2 million of members there. And they're basically saying, why do we have to pay the price? The European Union telling the government that we have to take, imposing higher taxes. We're going to have 30% less in vacation payment, etc. And we are the one who have to pay for it. And this austerity measure is only starting. You know, obviously, they wanted to reduce the deficit, which stands at 12.6% at the time being.
But Nadia, if you've got two-thirds of the Greek population not paying taxes, how do you correct the situation?
Well, unfortunately, like this. I mean, this is another time bomb that's been left ticking for the better part of two decades, created by the 92 Maastricht Treaty that created the Eurozone. All these countries wanted to be part of it. There was never an enforcement mechanism that, even though you had a certain level of GDP, deficit as GDP, you had to have as an entry. There was never, once you were in, you were in. And that's what happened to Greece. And everyone kind of looked the other way. You know, Wall Street came in and helped them sort of disguise their debt. And now the piper's come due, and basically they have this huge deficit they have to reduce.
And other European nations could be headed in the same direction.
Well, Spain and Italy have, huge deficits. And, of course, the problem here, and this was always a sort of a sleeping serpent with EMU, was that traditionally a country can control its own currency. And if you get into trouble with your fiscal situation, you can devalue your currency and make your economy more competitive. These countries can't do that because they don't have control over the euro, and the euro becomes a sort of a creature of the strongest country and the most secure country economically, which is Germany, which continues to dominate the EMU. So these countries find themselves without the tools that most countries have to deal with this kind of a situation when they run up deficits.
But doesn't Britain also have a problem, Warren.
We were talking about this actually a little bit before we went on air. They do have a problem. There's some banks who are saying that they're going to have a huge problem with budget deficits that are coming due. But as Michael pointed out, they are not part of the Eurozone.
Of course.
They have control of their own currency. And I've also read that some of the debt that is coming due is they have a longer lead time in order to make their debt payments, much longer than we do, for example.
But they're saying precisely that they don't have the time to leisurely wait till they were talking about halving the deficit by mid of this decade, 2010. And the criticism is they cannot afford to do that. They have to start taking austerity measures. Otherwise, they will end up the same as
Greece. Piper will come do theirs.
Yeah. Yes,
and,
exactly.
And, of course, you know, the great danger of all of this is countries impose austerity, which what austerity means is stopping growth or slowing growth. And that raises the specter of a double-dip recession for the global economy. You know, we're just starting, perhaps, to come out of one. And that's what has a lot of economists scared right up, you know, on this side of the pond as well, on Wall Street and in Washington.
So the discussion about what's happening to the world economy continues not only to expand, but perhaps to impinge on the recovery in this country.
Unquestionably, as does the discussion about what to do about Wall Street. You've heard the Greeks and other Europeans react against a lot of these derivative instruments.
Absolutely. Michael Hirsch of Newsweek, Nadia Bilbasi of MCB TV, Warren Strobel of McClatchy's News. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Gospels are at odds with each other on important points about the life and death of Jesus. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bible scholar Bart Ehrman about these contradictions and what they tell us about the historical Jesus and the authors of the Gospels. That's the subject of his book, Jesus Interrupted, which just came out in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to the international portion of our Friday News Roundup. Nadia Bilbasi with NBC is with us. Warren Strobel of McClatchy News. Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine. Let's go now to Chandler, Arizona. Good morning, Hanny. You're on the air.
Good morning. Diane, I have a point regarding the U.S. and the Israeli relationship. I believe that the U.S. support to the Israelis blindly. It's really hurting the U.S. Every principle that the U.S. stands, from human rights to war and terrorism to everything, when we support the Israelis, we are really testing our own principles. Like the Israelis are building settlements in the West Bank and occupied territories, it's totally against international law.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling, Warren.
I think when the U.S. doesn't support the Israelis as a practical matter, or the Israelis see that they don't have U.S. support, they're not going to move forward on the peace process. That's just a fact of life. To get them to push forward and to take risks for peace, they need to know that they have the full backing of their one and major ally.
But,
in the
you
world.
Know, Warren, you said earlier that Vice President Biden kept the Israeli Prime Minister waiting for 90 minutes. Is that a sufficient rejoinder to a government that says, we're going to go ahead, whether you're here to push the peace process or
no,
not?
No, but also, I mean, Warren, I mean, you can have a strategic alliance with any country. You talk about the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, U.S. and Pakistan, U.S. and Israel, but you have the right to criticize them when they commit something wrong.
Absolutely.
And Israel always commit a break of international law, and the American voted with them or abstained from voting in the U.N. So that's, I think, into what the callers are saying. But coming to the to what happened with Biden, I think it's not enough. I mean, he snubbed him as if he did some a break of etiquette when he didn't show up for 90 minutes. I mean, the Israelis are defying the U.S. fundamental position on demanding a freeze on the settlements, and the vice president leaves and said, everything is behind us. Now let's go forward.
I mean, there are certain political realities here. No U.S. government, no president is going to threaten a complete break with the Israelis or cut off aid. Obviously, constituencies here would be affected. But also, let's add a little balance here to the discussion. Support for Israel does not mean a violation of American principles. The Israelis are hardly the only ones in this conflict who have been violating international law in some sense. There are no Israeli suicide bombers. I know from a recent trip there that despite issues and some serious I think I wouldn't call them atrocities, but killings of innocents in the most recent incursion in Gaza, the Israeli IDF did try to operate as humanely as possible. I mean, there are two sides to this conflict, and there always have been. You know, I just would want to add a little balance to what the caller
Warren.
Said.
One last quick point here. I read this text of Biden's speech yesterday at Tel Aviv before he left. He made a very interesting point there to the Israelis, which is, you've got a president, a Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, and a prime minister, Salam Fayyad, who are about the best deal you're ever going to get. And you should make peace with these people because it's not going to get it any better from here on out. And so he was saying, make the deal. I mean, the Palestinian leadership has done a lot in terms of building security forces in the West Bank, in terms of cutting terrorism, in terms of trying to get economic growth there. I just thought it was a really interesting thing he said to the Israelis.
All right. Let's go now to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Arthur. You're on the air.
Yes, you know that in this whole Arab-Jewish discussion, one thing is omitted, that there is no political boundary de facto between the Arabs and the Jews in that area. What exists is the ceasefire line resulting from a truce when the Arabs tried to destroy all the Jews in Israel in 1948. And most of the Arabs who live in these so-called refugee camps were not indigenous to that area of land. They came in 1948 from other Arab countries which were devastated after World War II, and the UN so-called refugee camps was a place, a magnet, where people, Arabs, could go get food, get shelter, where they couldn't get it in their own countries, whether it was Egypt or Jordan or Syria or whatever. And the fact that now they're so called, there never was intended to be a two-state Arab-Jewish country. It was—
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Mark?
Well, I think, in fact, the UN, right after World War II, proposed a two-state solution or something, what we would today call a two-state solution.
Well, that was the partition plan. Palestine was...
But I think the problem with conflicts is always you have two perspectives into looking into realities. So the Palestinians will disagree completely with the viewers, with the listeners' assumption, because everybody looks at it from their own historical perspective, from their own suffering point of view, and therefore, you know, you can disagree or agree.
All right. right to Michael in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. So I just wanted to offer some perspective on the Nigerian comment and the recent Nigerian news. I always cringe when I hear it simply characterized as religious conflict. It's a really sad oversimplification. I mean, no offense, but these are historic ethnic, actually, conflicts that predate even the arrival of the British. And the Fulani and the people of that middle belt, which houses more than half of the 250 ethnic groups that make up Nigeria, have always had clashes. In fact, those people who are considered indigens of Jos were said to have converted to Christianity just to ally themselves with the British to provide some kind of resistance to Fulani incursions. And these skirmishes have gone on for years. They're sad, they're tragic, but you could almost say, if you wanted to oversimplify them, that the religion actually is just a coincidence. The main thing is the ethnic. And of course, if you, you know, talking about resources, it's still the same thing. The ethnic clashes arise because of resources. Mm.
I agree entirely. And that's not just in Nigeria, but most of Africa. If you look at Rwanda, Burundi, Congo, you look at Senegal and Gambia, you will see these artificial borders were created by the British and the French colonials at the time. They will cut a country into half, regardless of the ethnic tribes that live in there. Half of the country will be on this side, Anglophone, and the other will be Francophone. And therefore, I agree entirely. And the worst example that I've seen in history was obviously in the genocide in Rwanda, where, you know, Tutsis and Hutus were against each other, and the result was a discrimination during so many years by the Belgian colonial at the time. And when the majority takes over, they always discriminate in a grotesque fashion against the minority.
Thanks for calling, Michael. Let's talk about Secretary Gates' visit to Saudi Arabia. What was that for, Michael Hirsch?
Well, this is part of an intensive effort both to bring the Saudis back into the Middle East peace process, looking ahead to the Arab League meeting a couple weeks from now, and also to gain support, broad international support, but also in the Arab world for sanctions against Iran, which is now being discussed in the UN Security Council. And, of course, Saudi Arabia would be a very important part of that.
And what's the latest on those hikers in Iran, Nadia?
I think one of the other points I wanted to mention with Ahmadinejad's visit to Kabul was there was talk even that the American intelligence helped in the arrest of Abdelmalek Reji. And in return for that, Ahmadinejad government allowed them for the first time to call their families. And I don't think ever they're going to put them on trial or execute them. Or the
How
Iranians,
long are they going to keep them?
Well, they can keep them as long as their interest is there.
It's been
since July, right? It is a bargaining chip for them. So they know the value of these people, and they will play a game till the end. But the bottom line is, if you give us some good gesture here, then we will do something in return.
Am I the only one who thinks Ahmadinejad is a much diminished figure on the international stage? I mean, I'm sorry. I covered his first couple speeches at the UN Security Council, where people were hanging on his every word. But this is a guy who, he represents obviously an important country, but disputed election. He's not really in control, if he ever was. And I just think he's a diminished figure.
There is an air of desperation to some of these Iranian actions, which includes the keeping these three American hikers. A lot may have to be resolved first. Is there going to be an attack either by the Americans or the Israelis? What is the sanctions regime they're discussing going to look like? The Iranians don't really have, you know, a lot of chips, quite frankly. And they're even having problems technically with their nuclear program. So I would agree with what Warren just said.
So these hikers are going to be kept and kept and kept, Nadia.
Absolutely, until there is a good reason for the Iranian government to release them. I mean, I don't know if it's going to be an attack, a military attack on Iran or not, and I don't think if they're going to use them as a result of that. But for the time being, we have seen the scenarios, Diane, many times before, whether it was the British Navy sailors or other Americans, etc. But the bottom line is they are valuable for the Iranian government, and they will use them for propaganda reasons, and they use them for their own interests. When it's the time to release them, they will release them.
All right, let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Nike. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. My name is Nike. And
Nike.
I want to tell you I love you. I love your show so
Thank
much.
You.
It's a bit of fresh air every day I listen to it.
Thank you.
I am from Nigeria originally. And I've been listening to your callers and some discussants describing this issue as purely a resource control issue or an issue of tribal sentiment. No, it is 100% a religious issue. Usman Danfodio, the Arabic man that brought Islam to Nigeria, had a mission to move Islam up to the Atlantic Ocean down to the south. It was actually the colonialists, the British, that stopped that movement. And their means is of propagating religion is show you Quran on one hand and sword on the other hand. The missionaries from Netherlands came from the Atlantic Ocean from the south and converted the whole south to Christianity and up to just the central. Why the northerners, the Arabic guys, came from the north and started converting them down to the south. So just is the middle line where it stopped. The just people have been Christians. And even when they were not Christians, their traditional religion, which they were practicing, was a peaceful religion. The Igbos and Yorubas and other ethnic groups had been living in Jos even before the Fulanis came. And the Jos people are not fighting over land. They love visitors. They don't have problems with visitors. There are other tribes that lived in Jos for thousands of years. I'm an Igbo man, and Igbo people have been living in Jos even before the Fulanis came to Jos.
All right, Nike, thank you so much for your contribution this morning. Nadia, as you said earlier, it really depends on your perspectives,
of course. And if we're talking about Nigeria again, there is no doubt that the Muslim have dominated the political life of Nigeria. Actually, I was there in 1998, I think, to cover the first time of a transfer of government from a military rule to civilian during President Obasanjo. And he was the first Christian to lead Nigeria at the time. Of course, we're talking about a massive country, you know, with massive resources. We're not talking a tiny little African country. We're talking about, 150 million people. So this tension is going to be there. And when you have oil in the middle and these two ethnic groups or religious groups are fighting over it, then obviously it's going to be a conflict and it's going to be a bloody one.
Nadia Bilbasi of NBC TV, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about International Women's Day. That was Monday. Talk about the significance, Nadia.
It's very important. This is a topic obviously close to my heart. I think if women rule the world, you'll have a better world. That's for sure. And don't disagree with me, okay? of course, you look at the assessment, especially, for me personally, to look at the achievement of women in the Arab world and to see that they're lagging behind third world developing countries. It's unfortunate, but there is good signs now to see that actually they are part of a decision making. It's not just, they're in certain fields of education or medicine, but we want to see more participation of women. But in particular, I think it's a good example that we want to talk about is India. And you have to credit the parliament for allowing this law to pass that's been in discussion for a decade of giving one-third of seats to women. And I think the number in the lower chamber of the parliament is going to be increased from like 58 to 181, which is really great.
I think one of the wonderful things that's happened, I've covered foreign policy, national security for two decades, I'm ashamed to say now, a little bit more, out of Washington. And when I started, the issues were the Cold War and Arab-Israeli dispute, and women's issues was nowhere. And now it is a major issue for discussion around the world, between the United States. It's a priority, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's, and it's just fabulous to see how it's now really a front-burner issue, or at least an important one.
Yes. You know, it's interesting, Diane, this is the one issue that perhaps unites both sides of the spectrum in American foreign policy. The far-right neocons of the Bush administration were very big on trying to raise the profile of women in the Arab world. They felt it would be a stabilizing, democratizing force. And, of course, you have Hillary Clinton on the other side, who has made this a key issue ever since she was first lady. I will add, just as a footnote to what Nadia just said about women perhaps should be ruling the world, when the Israelis did shut down the West Bank and the Western Wall area, they made an exception for women. They were allowed to pray because the Israelis knew that they were not so likely to start a riot.
And certain men, wasn't that also the case?
Men over the age of 50,
exactly.
Right. The blood is cooled.
let's talk quickly about the significance of China and India coming to the international agreement on Copenhagen?
Well, they decided now that they wanted to join the Copenhagen Accord, but it's good because they will be part of the process as supposed to be from the outsiders. But to be honest, Diane, I don't think they will be effective, or rather it's not going to be a huge influence because the accord is not binding. And that's the bottom line.
And Ban Ki-moon has said he wants to see a full investigation of the accords reached and the underlying science.
Yeah, there the errors that were made in this 2007 report related to, you know, whether the Himalayan glaciers would melt or not are exactly the kind of errors that, frankly, climate scientists can't allow them to make because they get seized upon by the other side, the people who don't believe in climate change at all. And so Ban Ki-moon is, you know, attempting to sort of purge this report and the conclusions of this UN panel of any of this, you know, erroneous or overreaching information.
Warren.
There's a new Gallup poll out this week, in fact, that says that a rising number of Americans think the threat of climate change is exaggerated. It's now at 48%, which is almost half the country. And, yeah, as you say, with this issue being as the way it is, these kind of mistakes just play right into them.
Last word, Warren Strobel. He's with McClatchy's Washington Bureau. Nadia Bilbasi, senior U.S. correspondent for NBC TV, Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.